You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
And what's going on here?
Professor?
Please don't call me that.
Why, you know this guy?
Yeah, he looks slightly familiar. Get off the bloody chandelier, Hank.
You can walk.
You're a perceptive one.
I thought, Eric.
Which makes it slightly perplexing that you managed to miss our sign on the way in. This is private property, my friend. I'm going to have to ask him to ask you to leave.
Well, I'm afraid I can't do that because I was sent here for you.
Well, tell whoever it was that sent you that I'm busy.
It's going to be a little tricky because the person who sent me was you.
What?
About 50 years from now. I know. Stay with me.
50 years from now, like in the future 50 years from now?
Yeah.
I sent you from the future?
Yeah.
Piss off.
If you had your powers, you'd know I was telling the truth.
How do you know I don't have my... Who are you?
I told you.
You CIA?
No.
You've been watching me?
I know you, Charles. We've been friends for years. I know your powers came when you were 9. I know you thought you were going crazy when it started, all the voices in your head. And it wasn't until you were 12 that you realized all the voices were in everyone else's head.
Do you want me to go on?
I never told anyone that.
Not yet, no, but you will.
All right, you've piqued my interest. What do you want?
We have to stop Raven. I need your help. We need your help.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club, Trek FM's local watering hole. And let's just say we are definitely watering tonight. Ruby has served the drinks because as we are releasing this show, we are releasing on the 4th anniversary of the 602 Club. So a round of drinks for everybody, Ruby. Thank you so much for everybody who has tuned in and listened in for all of these years. I can't believe that, I guess they always say time flies when you're having fun. And it's definitely flying by when you're just sitting on this bar stool. Good drinks keep coming and great conversation. So here's to 4 more years and many more, hopefully, doing this. But I just wanted to say a quick thank you to everybody as we do celebrate those 4 years. And as always, you know, if you like the show, give us a star rating review over on iTunes. Let people know what you think of the show. And we'll call you out on the show. We'll thank you. We'll read your review. So let everybody know. Help the show grow. You know, 4 years, we've grown a lot, but we can definitely always find new listeners, and the best way to do that is with star ratings and reviews over on iTunes. Plus, follow us over on Twitter, Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can also find the show on all of the Trek FM shows over on iTunes at itunes.com/TrekFM. We've got the website at trek.fm. You can find our listeners-only discussion group. If you want to talk with other fans about everything that we're talking about here on the network from all the different shows, type Babel into the search field on Facebook. That's where our discussion group is held. Or if you're on the website at trek.fm, hit discussion on any of the menu bars. And then, last but not least, if you want to send us an email, love getting emails. Maybe you can send in your favorite shows that we've done or your favorite 602 Club memories, or maybe how you found the show. Go over to trek.fm/contact to choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and then that'll come to me and any host that is on that week. And this week, we are celebrating 40 years by talking about kind of the pinnacle of the X-Men franchise in the sense that it kind of all culminates from you know, X-Men, X2, X3, Wolverine, and then, you know, X-First Class. All of it kind of comes to a head with these different varied casts in Days of Future Past. And here to talk about that with me is X-Men expert Sean Eastridge.
I like it. I like it. Expert. I like what you did there. Matt, it's a pleasure to be back. It's a pleasure to be the expert. And I'm excited to talk about Days of Future Past. This is, I think for both of us, but I'll speak for myself just in case this is not the case. But what am I even talking about? I'm not the expert on
allow
speaking.
Myself to introduce myself.
Allow myself to introduce myself. Exactly. So I have not seen Days of Future Past since it was released in 2014. I think May 2014 is when this came out. So I have not seen it since theaters.
Yeah, I have. I've seen it a couple times since then. And I've obviously, especially too, because they released the Rogue Cut that came out, which we'll talk about later. And I've seen that as well. And so, and they are, I would say, there is a difference in the movies.
Huh, okay. I wonder, because I haven't seen the Rogue Cut, and I always wondered if it was literally, the vibe I get from a lot of people is it's they just shoved in a bunch of Rogue content. I didn't know how dramatically it altered the movie.
Yeah, there are some ways in which it does change the movie, for sure.
Well, one of the weird things I thought about it, not to delve too deeply into the plot, but it is strange that, or not too strange, X-Men is always, the film franchise at least, has always favored its Oscar-winning actresses. Halle Berry took the forefront after she won her Oscar, and Jennifer Lawrence is basically the new Halle Berry, quote-unquote. But it's interesting that Mystique became such a major prominent player when the powers of her, or the Sentinels' abilities seem more in line with Rogue. And so it's interesting that Rogue is nowhere to be found, that there ended up being a Rogue cut later. I see kind of on the surface level how it could be like, oh, well, Mystique, she transforms and stuff. But Rogue's the one who absorbs powers and stuff.
Yeah, well, heck, we'll just go ahead and talk about it. I think it's a great place to talk about because we have the two different movies there. The Rogue cut, one of the main differences is that when Kitty Pryde is hurt, Bobby thinks of the idea of rescuing Rogue, who is held in Cerebro, which is the in the old X mansion, which is heavily guarded because it's the only place that the professor can't make contact with is inside Cerebro. And so they rescue Rogue, who's being held, and they bring her back, and she absorbs Kitty's powers and allows her to continue what Kitty's doing so Kitty can stop.
Oh, interesting.
And not kill herself. In that process, Bobby dies. And
when they're
you
trying
also
to
get
recover
the answer
Rogue?
As, yeah. Oh,
wow.
And you also get the answer as to why the Sentinels find them in the first place, because one of the tracking devices inside a Sentinel hand that was severed, that was caught in the jet during their escape, leads the Sentinels back to where they are.
Okay.
So it actually creates, it makes more sense than, the Sentinels just happen to find them, like in the middle of nowhere, Tibet, you know. which I was thinking to myself, why wouldn't you just hide in like the Amazon? It seems like a much harder place to find people.
That's what I was,
with all the life forms.
That's what I was wondering when they were all standing outside the temple. I was like, why would you all stand outside the temple? Wouldn't you even try to hide yourselves from being seen? I guess at the end of the day, the Sentinels can detect
why
them.
Why isn't Storm creating more of a storm to make it really hard? Anyway,
she's got
to
do something. She's got to do something. Live up to that namesake.
Exactly. Well, that's the difference in the Rogue take. So it does really kind of create a different feel to the film. And in some ways, I think I enjoy the Rogue take more than what we'll talk about, which is the theatrical cut, because in many ways, when you see the Rogue cut, you can tell they cut those parts out and they had to stitch the movie together to make it work without her. You don't have to have her in it per se, but I do think there are things that make more sense when you put her back in and you have her scenes back in. And it does make sense, like you said, that the Sentinels are a combination of Rogue and Mystique's powers. and it makes sense why they would be holding her.
Yeah.
Because she would be pretty important to that continued research,
it,
is my guess.
It sounds like it also adds another action sequence to the movie, because something I was actually kind of surprised, the movie is never not engaging or not exciting, but it definitely had less overt action as far as like big action mm-hmm. sequences. You had a pretty like wham bam thank you ma'am opening. You have some stuff interspersed throughout. You have some stuff with Wolverine at the beginning that's kind of fun and goofy when he first wakes up in the 1970s. You have the great Quicksilver sequence, but for the most part, I kind of forgot how little it relies on big action set pieces, even less so I think than X2. It feels a little bit more in line with X1. Of course, it's more bombastic than that, but it does. I forgot how I was like, huh, there isn't as much. So the road cut, it sounds like they maybe were trying to find a way to insert more action into the movie.
Well, I think to this movie, you know, and one of the things that we called out talking about the X-Men films is that they kind of play by their own rules in a lot of ways. They don't seem to feel the sense that, oh, we have to have an action beat every 20 minutes. If the movie doesn't call for every 5 minutes somebody's, you know, getting an arm chopped off or something's blowing up, that we're losing the audience, that the story is dictated by the story and nothing else, which is great, because I think here the movie is more of an intrigue thriller about trying to save time than it is anything else. It's not necessarily, it's not created as one of those comic book, you know, this, I put it this way, it feels like a graphic novel.
Yeah.
Like this is meant to tell a story with all of these characters. This is kind of the culmination of everything that we've done in the X-Men movies.
Yeah.
This is their Infinity War.
Yeah, in a way it is. And you've got a great way of Days of Future Past. I remember when they announced that, and it was really, I remember my first thought was like, oh, okay, they found an excuse to get Wolverine back in there. But really, it's a cool way to honor the past and acknowledge the future of where it's going. And they did that also by bringing Bryan Singer back, which was very exciting for me as a fan of what he did with the first two movies. I was like, great, I'm on board. I'm ready for it. But it does kind of feel like that. And you're right. I mean, this feels like a graphic novel. It feels even more, I think, when Days of Future Past came out, really, and we've discussed this, I believe, but the X-Men franchise's biggest pitfall is that it happens to exist now in a world that has the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where we're so bombarded with Marvel movies and superhero movies. When X-Men started, it was not the norm. We had X-Men, which was a solid start. Then you had the first Spider-Man. Then you had X-Men 2, and that was like a whole other level. And then you had a whole slew of superhero movies coming in. But I think Days of Future Past, when it was released, I remember it did really well. It got great reviews. It did well at the box office. But there was a sense of going to see it like, what are they going to do? Like, how are they going to differentiate themselves? And like you said, I think what they really honed in on is this feels less like an action adventure movie than a sci-fi movie. I think the time travel really brings that out, but there's a lot of fun stuff, especially I think they really embraced what I think First Class did so well, which is kind of just focusing in on the styles of the decade and the fun stuff that the 60s had to offer. And they were like, all right, well, I guess that's our angle. We're going to really embrace the time era and have a lot of fun with that. And you feel that a lot in Days of Future Past.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I feel like that they do really well is they find a way to honor every single thing that's come before, even if it wasn't great.
Yeah.
You know, like they use bits and pieces of all of these movies to tie it all together. And I'll say this movie to me is everything that Infinity War is not.
Okay.
To me, Infinity War is an overly long, bloated mess that it doesn't find a way to find anything new to do to differentiate itself from everything else that's come before. It's just kind of a regurgitation of everything you've had. Whereas I feel like this movie, on a completely opposite end of the spectrum, is something very new, and it finds a way to honor both casts, to use them well, and to use them where they need to be used and not feel like they have to cram them in later. And it finds a way to actually forge as well a new future that could have been, if they had never done another X-Men movie, this could have been an amazing ending too.
Yeah. So, obviously I don't agree about Infinity War because I really enjoy the movie, but I think what Days of Future Past's advantages is that it's telling a complete story. There's hints, yeah, of course, yeah. That, you know, they tease there's a post-credit sequence because that has to happen. There's kind of not a cliffhanger of an ending, but a little tease at the end of like, oh, Mystique is Stryker, even though I don't know how much sense that makes. But I think, again, the advantage of X-Men Days of Future Past is it's a complete story. It told a complete story. One of, I think, my biggest pet peeves of Infinity War, as much as I enjoy it, I think is the fact that they kind of pull a fast one on you and they're like, it's the big culminating movie, and then it isn't really. It's kind of like it's part one of a two-part story.
Oh yeah, yeah, I totally
and
agree.
I think one of the things that the X-Men, what Days of Future Past kind of did so well, especially in this era of like, oh, it's, we have an episodic franchise going on, Days of Future Past kind of reminded me when I saw it of the good old days of superhero storytelling, where it was like, it's a standalone movie. Yes, it's a sequel. Yes, there are elements that, you know, they pull in First Class, they pull in the original franchise with the original team, but at the same time, it's you could almost go into Days of Future Past without knowing anything about the X-Men at all. You could kind of approach the franchise. I wouldn't recommend it, but if you were to be like, oh, well, the only X-Men movie I have available to me is Days of Future Past, should I watch it without having seen the others? I'd be like, yeah, sure. It's fun. You're going to have a good time, and you'll get what makes the X-Men so special.
Well, and they give you bits and pieces that you need from the previous films, whether it's a flashback or a scene or whatever, to kind of help set what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think they do a good job in that, too. The one thing that makes this very interesting is obviously, and I think a lot of people were excited when the movie was coming out, it's going to be a generational movie. We're bringing these two generations. You know, this is X-Men Generations.
Yeah, I had that. I was like, this is basically if Star Trek Generations had been way better,
good.
This is what it could have been.
Yeah. And so I was fascinated by that. How do you feel like they pulled that off in the film? Do you feel like it ended up working the way they wanted it to? And do you feel like that each of the generations were given enough of their due?
I think so. You know, I think the future storyline does suffer a little bit. I think there's, it's just the nature of the story. The fact that it's kind of, we kick things off with them setting the plot into motion and they have to take a back seat. But the story, and I think it's Simon Kinberg who wrote it, and of course, Bryan Singer is involved from a storytelling standpoint as well. They do a really great job of interweaving and finding ways to get back to that storyline. Having the scene, I'm sure one of their earliest discussions, like, we have to have a scene with Patrick Stewart and James McAvoy together having a conversation. How do we do it? And that was a really clever way of not only getting that scene to happen, but as a development for young Professor X, for that character, it's an integral part of his growth as a character. And that's one of the things I think Singer brought to this franchise that I really missed in X-Men 3 and X-Men Origins. But I even missed in First Class. I thought there were elements of First Class that were really moving. But Days of Future Past, I think, has a little bit more that's affecting to me. And a lot of it comes from Charles' character and his relationship with Eric, but mostly Charles is the one who has the most significant growth as a character. But I loved that, of course, we've got to get Wolverine in there, but I love that Wolverine isn't like the young, rebellious, reckless kind of guy that he's been painted as. He's now kind of the mentor to everybody. He's the one who's like, all right, guys, we got to get together. We got to do this. I don't know how we're going to do it, but he's kind of leading the charge and getting everybody back on their feet. I think if there's anything I could complain about, it wasn't something I noticed the first time, but this time around, I was like, you know, it kind of does stink that we don't get a lot of big X-Men team stuff in the movie. And by that, I mean, there is some good stuff in the future, but it would have been nice to see Wolverine team up with more than just Beast and Quicksilver. It would have been nice to see a couple more people in there. Maybe it could have been excessive, so I applaud them for kind of restraining themselves a bit. But I think if there's anything I would knock it for, it's that the very nature of the storyline doesn't allow for there to be as much of the team-up element as I would have liked. But there's enough good stuff in here that it doesn't really bother me that much.
One of the things that I thought was very smart in the movie is that there is no character that's precious. That every character and every part of the film has been crafted because it's needed, not because, oh, this will be cute or cool or any of that stuff. It's, you know, Wolverine is the way to get back into the past. And I think they created a very good reason for him to be the one to go back. I think it also culminated very nicely in the fact that he is basically the Professor X role, and Professor X is kind of the Wolverine role in this. The roles are reversed from the very first movie. And that's a great arc to have seen, because seeing that picture side to side of what Wolverine used to be like and now what he is, you know, like you said, he's become the mentor. And it's all because of what Charles will become. And there's that interesting role reversal now where and that time reversal where part of the reason that Charles becomes who he is because it's this time loop thing, right? You know, and so you get into that kind of fun sci-fi stuff. But, you know, I'm thinking specifically, you know, once Wolverine has served his purpose in the end, they just throw him in the ocean. You know, they throw him in the river because he's not needed anymore. And his part of the story is kind of over. But I appreciated that. Again, it's not that these characters aren't precious. They are there to serve the larger story that's happening, and the larger story is about all of these X-Men trying to survive. And so bringing these two generations together, you know, I do think you're right. The future story isn't quite as interesting as the past story, but it's good because in many ways, it is the past story that's going to make the future. So you don't want there to be such a competition between them. And I feel like you called out rightly that I think they do a good job of cutting back just enough to make you still interested in what's going on, and will they be able to do it? Will they be able to hold on long enough to change the past and save the future? So that you know, we can go back to the future. And I really, yes. I think it's just...
That's what it's really all about.
Yeah, it's when you want to go back to a better future, and... What we get here, I think, is really smart, and part of that is they didn't feel like they had to treat things as sacred. They treated them like part of the story and what's needed, and I feel like Singer did get that pretty well here. And you know, it's something that George Lucas talked about with Star Wars, is he doesn't treat it as sacred. It's just it's part of the story, you know? So, like, nothing is sacred in the sense that you wouldn't maybe try something. And here, I think they really shoot for the moon, and they do a great job of pulling off both of these casts. And, you know, Halle Berry's still awful, but...
there was a moment, I remember when I saw it in theaters, maybe I'm inventing this moment, but when she gets killed and it's played off as it's very dramatic and sad, I swear, like I said, I don't know if it was in my head, but somebody applauded in the theater when I saw it at midnight. I swear, like I said, maybe that was just wishful thinking on my part, which is terrible. I'm sorry, Miss Berry. I know you're listening. I apologize, but yes, this series is not necessarily her strong suit. And it was funny to see her though in such a reduced role after she was so ridiculously expanded in X-Men 3, as like, now she's the leader of the group, and now it's like, no, now she's just a bit player who gets killed at the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, I completely agree. I think there's a lot of stuff in here that's really great. Again, it's the advantage of taking a look at and saying, what is the story we need to tell? How can these characters help us tell this story? And it's in a way that I think is more effective than First Class. Maybe because it feels like the stakes are more visceral. First Class, for some reason, to me, feels... It has a really cool James Bond vibe to me, but there's something sort of goofy about it. Like, it embraces the goofiness of Bond, but also kind of the campiness in a way that makes it difficult to take things seriously. And with Days of Future Past, I feel a little bit more like, okay, I know what the stakes are. The action is a little bit more intense, and the emotional journeys are a little bit more intense as well. And I don't know. I did you How did you feel about Days of Future Past following First Class? Did you feel like, yes, this is better? Was there ever a conversation about it, or was it an immediate reaction?
Yeah, 100%. I feel like this, to me, especially when this came out, this was the best X-Men movie that it ever made.
Oh, wow.
Like this, and it was one of, and it still is. I mean, rewatching it, I was reminded that this is one of my favorite comic book movies because of the way that it all puts together, the way it all fits together. And part of what you're saying there with the idea of the kind of the goofy campiness of some of First Class, the X-Men movies have always been very good about taking themselves seriously and treating their world very seriously. And it's kind of in many ways the anti-MCU in that way, where we're not here to make jokes about what's going on. We're here to deal with it. Now, this movie's got a lot of funny in it, but it is built into those scenes. It's part of the DNA of what's going on. It's not just a quip every 2 seconds because that makes people laugh.
Yeah.
I think that is the thing that makes this movie really work, is that it knows when to take itself seriously, and it knows when to let you have those moments to just sit back in awe at something that's happening on the screen that, you know, we'll talk about later. Or it lets you have those moments to be able to chuckle, you know, because of something that's funny. But for the most part, this is a very, you know, this is universe ending stuff, you know, that's meant to be kind of serious. And they take it as such. And I think that's really important. Because the less serious the movie, the more jokes that are in comic book movies, the less I take the story seriously. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have world-ending paradoxes and, you know, time travel and the universe could end kind of thing, you should probably take that kind of seriously. Otherwise, it's hard for me as a viewer to then really take your movie very seriously. And the storyline really matter. And this, I feel like, you know, the thing of putting these two generations together and doing it the way they do it with the writing, they live up to the story they've created.
Yeah.
And they don't ever take any cop-outs.
Yeah, it's a really great way to... by this point, the X-Men timeline had become so convoluted because you had the first three movies and with the first two being on such a different level of quality than the third one. And the third one kind of went nuts, just killing off everybody. So things got really screwy. First Class took it back. And then it's kind of like, well, wait, where is this leading into the X-Men movies? Where does this fit into the timeline? So Days of Future Past is a really great way to kind of just like, okay, let's take a breather. All right. Yes, we understand. We kind of screwed things up. So we're just going to reset it a little bit. We'll get rid of the movies you didn't like and we'll embrace the good ones. But in a it's really, they did it in a way that felt organic. Like, that's what's cool about it is, I mean, it's taken seriously, but there is always a sense of fun to it. And there is a sense of, there is a sense of delight. It feels like feels like the event movie that it should, with having this great cast bringing all the characters together in this way. And it's fun. There are a lot of fun pairings. I think what I really would have loved to see is if you could take Scott, Jean, and Kurt from X-Men Apocalypse and find a way to get them into this movie without it being overwhelming. I know it's not possible. That would have been nice, to have a little bit more of like, oh, here's the current X-Men team, here are the characters we're familiar with. But at the same time, like I said, this movie, part of what makes it work so well is it doesn't feel overwhelmed, it doesn't feel bloated. It knows exactly which characters are needed for the story, and it tells the story that way.
What did you think, because part of this is what they decide to do with the time travel rules, and it allows you to be able to pay homage to everything that's come before and say it all matters. But at the same time, by the end of this movie, it does create a new future that we're moving towards. So you know that everything that's going to happen then and whatever movies follow this with that newer cast, the younger cast, will lead to the future that you're seeing Wolverine in, where it's all happy.
Right. Now, my question is that the future that ends up leading into Logan? Like, have we created this new... Because my watching it this time, I was trying to figure it out. Because time travel is always super funky, and it can never make sense. But I liked the stuff. I liked the little things they did. Like I liked that when Stryker gets the taser in his neck and he's on the verge of death, that throws Wolverine off. It was a really cool way to remind you of the stakes of time travel and how important it was that they not screw anything up too badly. But I was wondering about how the timeline splits now. So X-Men 1, 2, and 3 lead to Days of Future Past, but now that Days of Future Past happened, like you said, you have Apocalypse, you have Dark Phoenix, and then you also have, I assume, Logan at some point. I'm not exactly sure how it works, and it frankly I feel like it would give anyone a headache trying to figure it all out, unless you're really into quantum physics and you're desperate to figure out the timelines of the X-Men movies.
Well, and it's interesting because what they decide to go with is classic sci-fi Star Trek time travel rules. Yeah.
And X-Men has always felt very Star Trek-y. Yeah. Like, it's always felt like the Star Trek.
They even have a Star Trek episode playing in this
Right, exactly. I think that was a nice little nod. But it's always felt like, I think maybe because of the ensemble, because it's a little bit more thoughtful, I've always felt like X-Men is more comparable to Star Trek. Plus, I mean, X-Men 2 has the pretty much the same ending as Wrath of Khan. So, I mean, there's homages there too. Mm-hmm. But it's true.
So
yeah, I didn't think
cerebro?
About that. What's up?
It's more cerebro.
It's more cerebro. Exactly. Thank you, Matt.
Yeah. So I think the thing, though, that by doing that, by telling us and even showing us the Star Trek travel, time travel episode, you understand the rules that they're playing with, which is that you can go back in time and change the past and impact the future. Mm. You're not going to just create a split universe. Now, they talk and they reference some other time travel theories, you know, about time being, you know, river,
right.
And, you know, you that
you
kind
can't
of stuff.
Change anything.
But
yeah.
what they hold to is that this is a classic sci-fi time travel style movie. And I think that's really smart because then you know the rules you're playing with, you know. Mm. And I felt like that was just a great way. And again, what it allows you to do is to say that, you know, you start with X-Men, you go all the way through X-Men 3 and then Wolverine. And then that makes it, and then you come back and you see the past and, you know, it all ties together and it all matters. But at the same time, we're then writing a new future, which allows us, it's kind of this weird cyclical motion, but it's not a circle, it's a cyclical, and it creates another loop around. And so it's a good idea.
Do you think it ruins the stakes at all for Dark Phoenix? If we know, like if Dark Phoenix leads into future Scott Jean, we know that they all survive. Do you think that ruins the stakes at all?
You know, not to me personally, just because, you know, I would rather the Dark Phoenix story go in a way to which she can be saved than be her to be lost forever. So, I mean, I guess it'll be very interesting to see what they do in that. If they kind of behold themselves to that timeline. Or if they just kind of, you know, the end of Days of Future Past and its time travel thing, is that just that they've created an alternate universe or, you know, a parallel universe then where you go with kind of the Star Trek 09 feel. So,
right.
You know, you could do whatever you want because it's... Because
that's the beauty of time travel. It doesn't make any sense. If it did, we'd be doing it all the time and ruining everything.
Yes. Well, one of the things that's fascinating to me about this movie is Trask. As a character, one, Peter Dinklage plays it perfectly.
Oh, he's great, and it makes me happy because I remember they cast him, and it was right around the point where Game of Thrones was really like, this is the thing. So to see him in another role and to play it like you said so well it made me very happy because I love Peter Dinklage. Who doesn't love Peter Dinklage? Let's be honest.
I don't know. How could you not? I mean, you know, he's an angry elf. but I was
it was interesting to me because he has that conversation with Stryker that always makes me slightly confused because he's talking about the dangers of mutant kind, and then he switches his whole thesis and saying, no, I actually really respect them, and I feel like, you know, they could be the saviors of humanity, basically. And I'm like, so which is it? They're either the most dangerous thing on the planet and they need to be eradicated, or they're going to help us getting to the future?
I think that's his sales pitch, because, the sales pitch is basically, mutants are dangerous, buy my Sentinels. But in reality, I think he's so fascinated by them because of what they can do for him. So I think he's like, no, I respect them a lot, but in a like sociopathic kind of way where he's like, I respect them a lot. I respect what they can do. I'm going to experiment on them and find out everything. So that'll pave the way for us and how we can bridge the gap between us and them. I think it's a very like kind of maniacal sort of respect where it's not healthy. But I think it kind of his sincerity is a little twisted in that scene where it's all at the end of the day, his respect for them doesn't extend much further than what they can do for his technology.
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah. But he's great. He's so good. And I remember, I still think I would have liked a little bit of something maybe to address. I don't know if it matters really, but there was something about casting Peter Dinklage, and because of his stature, just having a moment maybe where he addresses it. They have a little joke where they're like, oh, a little freak of nature like you. I don't think that's a line. It's whatever they say, but at the when he's talking to Congress and trying to get his Sentinel program passed. But it would have been nice to have a little personal moment with him where he talks about maybe like, you know, my whole life I've been made fun of or da da da, but I'm going to create the thing that saves us. And look, you thought I was a freak, but now I'm doing that. Something like that to make it a little bit more personal. Cause I feel like as good as Dinklage is, you don't really get a sense for why Trask is so motivated to do this. Like what drives him to do this, other than the fact that he's like, yeah, I want to do this. It's great.
Well, one of the things that I found pretty fascinating is that we see play out the problem of what he wants to do. And, you know, that his creation, it's like Sentinel Skynet. It becomes a problem not just for mutants, but it becomes a problem for most of mankind, since these genes, not Jean Grey, but these mutant genes can be passed down for generations to generations, right, before they become maybe active in somebody.
It's Minority Report. So it's like they're, Skynet meets exactly. Minority Report.
Yes, it's like the Sentinels had a baby with Skynet and Minority Report, the cogs, and, you know.
It's perfect. That's cogs. A movie I want to see.
It's X-rated. So that is, I mean, the whole thing about a person, and I think what it kind of got down to with Trask, it's the bad guy who wants to control the things which he should not be controlling. Mm-hmm. And what you see is that Trask trying to play God almost destroys the planet.
Yeah.
And I think I always enjoy when, you know, the plan, even as well-intentioned as he thinks he is one that puts him in a position that he shouldn't have the position.
Right.
Because he's just a human being in the end.
Yeah. And it's that classic sense of, right, you're talking about somebody who wants the power of a god and then gets his comeuppance. For me, the best villain, I think, of this entire series, of course, Magneto's great, but I love William Stryker in X-Men 2, and it's tough for me because X-Men 2 is such a perfect movie as far as I'm concerned, and Stryker is such a great villain because his motivations are so sinister, but he has such a personal motivation for what he does. His son Jason is a mutant, and you get a nice little tease, a nice little Easter egg where they mention Jason in this movie. But I think I was missing that from Trask, is that emotional undercurrent. I think Days of Future Past, why I enjoy it, but I don't love it in the same way I love the first two X-Men movies, is there does feel there isn't as strong of an emotional undercurrent, but I think there's arguments to the contrary, like Charles' story and his relationship with Raven. There's a little bit of stuff with Eric, too. I think the second half of the movie, once Eric and Charles kind of team up and are back together, the movie kind of takes its time to find those emotional beats a little bit more than the first half. And it makes it more effective. And I really enjoy that a lot. But is there anything, like, as far as Days of Future Past, what about it do you think, from an emotional standpoint, does it do better than maybe the first couple X-Men movies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, you were mentioning the whole combination of Magneto and Charles and Xavier working together. And it is finally the death of that us versus them for Magneto. Because he says, you know, we wasted all of those years.
Right. That's such a great moment.
Fighting each other. And it's such a beautiful moment because it's that recognition that for so long, I made it about us versus them. I made it this fight when it didn't have to be a fight. When if I had been doing it your way, Charles, if I'd been trying to show people a better way of working together and being united together, that we could have changed the future for the better. And instead, I helped create the future that we've got. Mm.
I love it. And I love, really, of course, liked... that's intercut with the scenes of him,
yes.
Michael,
yes,
Fassbender, Magneto, doing all the horrible things that, yep, would, you, yep, know, bring about this terrible future. But yeah, it's such a great moment. There are a lot of, I think Singer really hones in this movie, and with the first two X-Men movies, it's why I love them so much. He does find time to get those emotional beats and those little character moments that really humanize everybody and really give you a sense of emotional stakes.
Well, and it's the emotion on top of the thematic element, which is so important to the X-Men franchise as a comic book series, and to translate it into film, you want it to have that same resonance as well. And it is these timeless themes, you know, the whole thing about that Charles and specifically, you know, Eric learning that he didn't have to be against Charles, he didn't have to be against humanity. That he could have made the world better is huge. But, I mean, it's the whole thing, too. Raven thinks killing Trask is going to make things better. But in the end, it makes things worse because it creates another layer of that whole us versus them thing that explodes and creates the need, what humans think of that aren't mutants, the need for Sentinels, that we need to control this population. Look what they can do. You know, it continues to build into this idea of fear. And so what we get is this theme running through, that's been running through all of the X-Men movies, and finally finds its culmination here when Eric just admits, I shouldn't have been fighting you all those years. Yep. We should have been together. And to hear him say that, it finally feels real, you know, like it feels
earned.
It feels,
in a lot of ways, it feels like Singer's trying to almost retroactively make his X-Men 3 in a way, like give us some of the moments maybe that might have ended up in the capper to his trilogy that he never got to do. With little things like that. But did you find it? I thought it was a little silly that it kind of the whole thing is Mystique kills Trask and that's what sets everything off. But at the very end, you know, it's like things are going badly. Mystique's still out and, you know, the future is still grim. And then Magneto comes and ruins everything by dropping a freaking stadium on the White House, and I thought it was kind of goofy that they were like, but no, as long as Mystique, as long as we stop her from killing him, then it'll all be okay. And they're like, yeah, you know what, we don't need the Sentinels. And I was sitting there thinking, wait a second, you just saw a mutant drop a football stadium on the White House. You do need Sentinels. But what do you think of that? Did that seem,
well, yeah, I think to me, you know, that becomes the whole, again, the very beginning of the movie, they have the conversation in the future about their choice. Do we do this or do we not do this? And the question became, if we do this, will some of us even exist? Or will we be willing to sacrifice our lives, maybe even not existing, for there to be a better future for people we don't even know?
Mm.
And So the idea of self-sacrifice, and on top of that, the fact that Charles has spent most of his life in the past kind of trying to control people because he's been used to being able to do that. And what he's learned is that you have to let people make your choices.
Right.
All you can do is show them the light, show them a better way, show them a better path, live that path so that people can see, you know, basically become a good witness for what your beliefs are and hope that other people will want to join you. And you put those two things together and you get the end where, you know, he allows Mystique to make the choice. Mm-hmm. And what we see is that Mystique is not the character that we know from Singer's other X-Men movies. This right. is a Mystique who will go on to be a different type of character. And it's because of the choices that she is allowed to make. She's not forced to make them by Charles. She's not coerced into making them. She gets to make them on her own. And in the end, it kind of becomes, you know, that Harry Potter lesson of, you know, it's our choices that define who we are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, it could be somewhat a little bit cheesy, but I do think that it's a moment that's kind of earned there where I could understand, the moment of, and I mean, kind of shocking that it would come from Richard Nixon, but the moment of having you being dead to rights, like you would be dead if it was not for the mercy of somebody else.
Yeah.
And realizing that, you know, again, it's not us versus them. They're not our enemy. They don't have to be.
Sure.
And the choices that we make here will either turn them into enemies or they will turn them into hopefully friends one day. And what we choose is to be friends. And I think in many ways, like you were saying, this is Star Trek, and we want, and Singer is doing the Star Trek thing, which is he shows us what the best version of what we could be is. Mm-hmm. And that's where we end on the movie. And I think that's
the personal touch of it is what, I mean, that's what makes it work, because it is at the end of the day, I think it's like, if you've got guys like that out there, maybe the Sentinels aren't so bad. But I do like the idea of it comes down to that very personal relationship between Charles and Raven, and him saying, "I will let you make the decision. It's up to you."
Right. Well, and I mean, they even make the decision with him and Magneto too, because you know, and Eric makes the decision to walk away, to fly away. So
he's like,
but
peace
out. To not continue it any further. And so, and it leaves you with that sense that there's a path to redemption for this character. And I think that's another important thing about the movie, is that allowing for the chance of redemption. I mean, we live in a world where I feel like it's becoming less and less kosher to allow there to be redemption for people. Even people who've made, you know, maybe a bad mistake. But do we want to live in a world that's not an option?
Yeah.
That it's one and you're done. Otherwise, you know what? We're all guilty. So, I mean, you can point fingers at people all you want, but in the end, none of us are perfect people. So the whole point of seeing that we can let people choose another way, we can show them another way. We have to give them a chance to find redemption then. Otherwise, you know, yeah, we just lock people up, throw away the key.
Yeah, that's true. I, you know, something else I like about Days of Future Past that I did notice the first time I saw it in theaters is that the climactic sequence, what we've been talking about, isn't as much about the big action, which is, it was an interesting change of pace, but also I think something that stood out as what made the X-Men franchise so unique, at least when it's working on, or it's firing on all cylinders. But it really is, it's a personal thing. But as far as the action goes, like I mentioned, it feels a little bit more muted as far as action. You don't really have Wolverine do an all-out berserker rage. He kind of has a little bit of fight, but then he gets all strung up with metal and thrown into a river. He doesn't have a big action sequence. Maybe it's not necessary because we've had about 50 Wolverine movies with him doing a berserker rage. But is there any action sequence in this that stands out to you, or any particular moment?
Well. I do think, you know, you really get in the film the standout scene, which is the Quicksilver scene.
Yes. I don't think anyone will disagree with that.
Well, and not only that, but I think that it's a movie that took the idea of super speed and just really played with it. And the as fast as he's going, I mean, you would have to be going near the speed of light to be able to do what he's doing. Because but in the end, it's a comic book movie, and so to really play with that and create that moment that feels like six splash pages put together is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I adore that. I mean, the music choice, the sheer
brilliant.
Hilarity of
it's
it.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. That's definitely a standout moment for me. I love the moment. Another great sequence, like I said, is when they go to confront Mystique, who's in the office with Trask and everyone else, and she's about to kill him, and you have Stryker getting zapped. Wolverine's kind of losing his mind. They do a really great job. We talk a lot about the intercutting of future and past, and I thought that was a brilliant way halfway through the movie to remind us of the stakes of the future, that it is something where there is time travel playing into it, because we spent a lot of time in the past at this point, and we haven't spent a lot of time remembering that there is Wolverine is being transported back. So the way they manage to make it intense, I love the moment where Mystique jumps out the window, Magneto shoots the gun, but she's already escaped, and then he guides the bullet down after her. It's such comic book glee, but it's also a really great way, storytelling-wise, to connect the dots and make sure you understand the stakes on both sides of the timeline.
What did you think of, this movie's production and the effects there, the production value of it from the past and the future, and then because they're creating two different types of worlds. One doesn't exist at all, the other was in the past. All of that, how did you feel like this movie works, and do you feel like it still holds up production value wise?
Honestly, I think some of the future stuff feels a little dated, ironically, since it's the future. It shouldn't feel dated, but it does. Some of the effects work is a little wonky. I think it's just When you're looking at a big effects movie and you find yourself in a situation where you have to create a fantastical world that is clearly not real, sometimes I tune out pretty quickly because I'm like, oh, it's a digital landscape. I also think their costumes were a little silly. It looked a little, I don't know. There was a laser tag place called Ultra Zone back in Northern Virginia when I was growing up, and it reminded me of like the laser vest you wore when you would go in and fight. It just made me think of like Ultra Zone, like they were shooting on an Ultra Zone set. But I think the past stuff works for me, because whereas the future, you can kind of like, oh, they're all wearing black leather. There's kind of a Tron element to it. Like the things look a lot like Tron Legacy, the machines and everything. Those aesthetics look familiar, but the fact that you have the 70s angle, I think gives the movie its unique flair. And for me, the past sequences from a visual standpoint work better for me than the future sequences. And I think the special effects work better because they're surrounded by more real settings and real world situations in the past than they are in the future. But I do love that we get a really cool all-out action sequence with the X-Men at the beginning of the movie. I thought that was a great way to start. And I almost feel like it's Bryan Singer kind of saying F you to everybody who was like, Superman Returns is so boring, and why can't he direct a good action movie again? And he was kind of like, oh yeah, action movie? Okay, great. I'll start my next big comic book movie with a crazy action sequence. But I did like that. But I think the effects were a little wobbly for me at times. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I think there are a few scenes here and there where the effects are, part of that's the time period you're in. And part of that is I think there are 30 different companies that are working on this movie. So there can be different places where it's good and where it's not. For the most part, I was surprised is that the movie holds up really well. And because we don't spend an enormous amount of time in the future, that really helps, because we're not reminded of that. And then, I think you're absolutely right. The production value of the rest of it is fantastic. The period stuff they do is all great, when they're
there's a lot of really clever, having Nixon in there is so goofy because that's such a caricature. But like the way they managed to like fit little subtext stuff in there, like the Professor X's heroin, quote unquote, addiction, like being able to to find a way to comment on that without going into the subject of heroin. But like little things like that, I loved. I forgot about the gag of like why did they lock up Eric? Oh yeah, he assassinated JFK. How else could you explain the magic bullet? I thought that was so brilliant. But those little touches are so great. I thought it was really clever how they managed to fit all those little nods to the decade into the movie.
Well, and on top of that, you have a movie that I just feel like works when you put the whole thing together. All of these scenes together, you put all of these characters together, and you put the story together. It's something that you watch, and it works. And that's something that's really important in a comic book movie, mm-hmm. to have the whole really come together. You know, you can always have in comic book movies, you know, I'd say, I don't dislike Superman Returns, but there are things that where I definitely feel like it could be better. Mm-hmm. But you can pull out that one scene at the beginning of the movie with the airplane crash, and it's one of the best action sequences. And it may be one of the best Superman action sequences ever created. It could be the best, maybe. You never know. I mean, that's the debate there, because it's very, very, very good.
And then it's in the midst of like two and a half hours of him kind of moping.
Yeah, you want to talk about moping? People complain about Man of Steel. Anyway, that's another subject. My point is that you can have these different movies, and they can have parts of them that work, and that we will come out talking about. But I think the thing about I'm noticing about this movie is that it's a cohesive whole. Mm. It all works together to create something that you enjoy being on the entire ride with, but you also appreciate all that came before even more, mm-hmm. which is great. You know, I can even appreciate the crappiness that is X3 because there are parts of that that play into this. You know, Wolverine Origins, all of those things. Every single X-Men movie is given its due in the sense that it is treated with the same amount of respect, and that all of those movies have played into this. And I think that's an accomplishment, mm-hmm. to say everything behind you is better now because of what we created here. But it also created a future that I thought, okay, if they never create another one, I'm good. If they continue this, I'll be interested to see what happens. But I am satisfied.
Yeah. And I think part of what's so funny about it is they respect X-Men 3 by saying, we respect that you exist, and now we're going to pretend that you don't. And everything you did, we'll just undo that, and we'll bring all the characters back. But
I think, you know, in many ways, it is kind of the genius of what JJ does in Star Trek 09. Where he says, I respect everything that came before, but now we're going to play in a universe where we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, it's very similar.
And in many ways, that's what they do here. And I think it's a smart thing to do, to treat your audience with respect. To treat your audience with respect to, there are people that like Wolverine Origins. There are people that like X3. Mm-hmm. So you treat them with respect. You don't tell them they shouldn't like it. You just say, yes, all of that happened, all of that matters, and it all culminates in the story we're telling here. And I think that's what makes, you know, to me, so far, it makes X-Men Days of Future Past the best, like, culmination movie, mm-hmm. of a superhero franchise. Like, it's the one that I think has done it the best. And so I guess that only leads us to one question. If you were going to rate, you know, Days of Future Past, what do you think?
I think the first time I saw it, I'd probably give it a 4. I think this time I'll say 3.5, mainly because I think there's a lot I love about this movie, and I think it's a really solid action movie. I think in some ways it just is just one of many. That's not so much this movie's fault as it is just the times we're living in, and not enough about it stands out to me to make it really be like, man, this is like X-Men 1 or 2. But overall, I think this is it's such a return to form for me. It was such a return to form for me in a way that I think I thought First Class was when I first saw it, but it really wasn't. Days of Future Past was great. From the moment, I mean, from when John Ottman's score kicked in, I just remember I was almost in tears in the theater. I was so happy to have that theme back. And it really, as an X-Men 1 and 2 fanboy, seeing it honored in that way and seeing someone like Singer, who has such a respect for the source material, come in and do something and kind of get a chance to riff on X-Men again, that was really the delight for me. And the stuff in the past is great. The stuff in the future is a little silly with the design and the costumes, but I think overall Days of Future Past still holds up. I think it's maybe a really great snapshot of a really great example of superhero movies, kind of not the last great superhero movie, as if there aren't great superhero movies being made, but in a way, as we were saying, just a standalone feel. It feels like a complete story, even as it's a sequel, even as it's kind of a prequel, quote unquote. It feels almost out of its era in a way, and I it's fun to go back and rewatch it.
I think the thing that I really appreciated about getting to watch this again was the fact that I feel like the movie really does hold up in the storytelling sense. Like all the things that you need for a movie to work, you know, effects come and go, because that's just, they're always going to be getting better. So many times for me, I have to let that go, because in the time it was amazing. You know, when this movie came out, I don't think any of the effects I would have thought, oh, that looks like a little cheesy. You know, now I say that because, you know, we're years removed from when this film came out. And so I really do feel that this is a movie that, you know, it's been 4 years since that came out. So
that's nuts.
I think that it's a movie that does the comic book genre a solid. Like I mean you watch this movie and you're like, okay, yeah, I get why we watch these kind of movies. Mm-hmm. You know why we like these kind of movies. And to me, like you said, it's a joy, because it is one I don't have to have sat through all the other movies to watch this one and really get the most out of it. I can still just pop in this movie and enjoy it, you know. And I don't know. And I hate to compare them, but I don't know if you can do that with Infinity War, mm-hmm. per se.
Yeah.
And just really get the most out of it if you haven't seen, you know, Iron Man in 10 years.
Yeah. I think Infinity War is the culmination in a way that Deathly Hallows kind of is, in terms of like there's a continuing story that's been leading up to this. But also, we're going to cop out and make you come see part two, also known as Avengers 4. But yeah, Days right. of Future Past, I think because of the fact that it feels like such a complete storyline, makes it feel a little bit more like a standalone product.
Yeah, and because of that, you know, to me, this is a very solid, I mean, and I say very solid, it could be even 4.5, but I'd say it's a good 4 out of 5.
Do you think it still, does it still hold up to your original...
Yeah,
viewing?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've got in Letterboxd too. Okay. And I would still say, you know, I was looking at my Letterboxd ratings for just like, I have favorite superhero movies, and it's rated number 8.
Nice.
Right after Logan.
Where does it rank in your X-Men franchise?
You know, I think it's number 1. Yeah, it's number 1.
But what about Logan? So does Logan, we were talking about this
so,
a little
well,
bit.
Well, it's Logan. So I put Logan in there, and so it's Logan, Days of Future Past, okay. X2. First Class, 1, and then blah, 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 blah.
I think I would go 2-1. I think before I rewatch this, I would probably put Days of Future Past next. I think now I would put Logan next and then Days of Future Past. But as we were discussing before the show, Days of Future Past is a better superhero movie than Logan, which is not to say that Logan is not the better movie. It's just, I think the fun, the sci-fi elements, the zany comic book action makes Days of Future Past feel more like a comic book movie. And Logan is very much about subverting those expectations.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I would say, you know, in many ways, Logan is a drama.
Yeah.
You know, it is just a pure drama.
in you know, the Godfather type sense. You know, it has that kind of gravitas and weight to it. It has that kind of emotion to it. So it's a very heavy movie. Mm-hmm. I love Logan. Absolutely love it. I think it's one of the best comic book movies ever. Obviously, it's rated 6 on my favorite comic book movies list. But it's also a movie that I don't just pop in anytime. Like, I have to be prepared to watch Logan because,
brace yourself,
it's like Schindler's List. I don't just watch Schindler's List whenever, you know? So, but no, I think, you know, we had started this out throughout the year doing these films because, well, we were supposed to be getting the Dark Phoenix film, and that's been pushed to next year. So we'll have to wait and come back to that next year. But I really want to say a huge thank you to everybody who makes this show possible. We actually have a brand new associate producer through Patreon, Ryan Millett, as well as Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, and Daniel Noah, who make sure that the 602 Club comes to you each and every week. I mean, and some of these guys have been supporting the show from almost its inception. Wink, wink, inception. I'm not that clever. Anyway, but I really do want to say a huge thank you because, again, as this has been 4 years in the making, it's been a real joy to get to sit around and talk about movies like this with amazing guests that come on every week. You get new people to come in and talk about their thoughts on films. And so really I just want to say thank you for supporting us, for listening, hope for your continued support. And one of the best ways to do that is to go over to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of our team here at Trek FM, because there's no way that we can put together this network without the support of people just like you. It costs way too much. It's a huge network. It's a huge undertaking. It costs a lot to do this. So go to patreon.com/trekfm. We've got some great contribution levels, but honestly, every little bit helps. So become part of our team. And again, thank you all of you that do support us. And for all of you in the future past that will support us. Now, Sean.
Yes, sir.
If people wanted to maybe catch up with you on some sort of, I don't know, I guess, I guess if you had the internet,
yes,
that
the
thing, you know, that they didn't have
in
the 70s.
What the kids call it these days.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you could,
but if somebody wanted to find you on the interwebs, where can people find you?
So you can find me on Twitter at YaySeanDoorman. I'm hanging out there every so often. And you can also find me on the Nerd Party Network doing the show Missing Frames, which is a podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives, but for whatever reason have not. So feel free to check that out. I hope you do. And I'm all around. I'm all around. Come shout at me.
And on Twitter, make sure if you want to shout out at Sean, make sure to use all caps. That way you
I need to know. I want to know that you're shouting at me, please.
Exactly. Please. You can find me on Twitter as well if you want to shout at me, MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram under the same name. I am also here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones as we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and The Orb. I'm on the Nerd Party Network as well. I do Owl Post with Drea Kaufman talking about Harry Potter each and every week as we dive in one chapter at a time. We're almost finished with the Goblet of Fire, so make sure you're following us. I know. It's
How
so
long has
fun.
That taken?
It has taken... it's almost halfway. We actually have more episodes left in the last three books than we do in the first three.
That's amazing.
That's crazy.
Yeah. This tells you, for those of you who aren't familiar with Harry Potter, that tells you how long the latter half of the series is.
Oh, it's good stuff. So
it's
great. Can't wait. You can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills talking about Star Wars each and every week. I love doing that show. It's such a blast. And if you're a Star Wars fan, or even if you're not, it's the place for you because we'll make you one.
Or if you're a John Mills fan, which they're out there. You know.
Few and far between.
Yeah, few and far between. Very few, very far, but they're out there.
Whatever, I'm one of them. You can also find me on one more show called Cinema Stories, and that's where I talk about films through the lens of faith with my good friend Courtney. But even after 4 years, thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back next year.